www.themouthmagazine.com.
On this edition of The Mouthcast, an artist who first rose to prominence in the autumn of 1983, initially as a one-man band, but with something of a twist. He enjoyed a string of radio-friendly hit singles and top 10 albums, which combined the futuristic spirit of the synthesizer pioneers with a much more traditional songwriting. On his first few singles and his number one debut album, Human's Lib, in 1984 at least, for the British mainstream, he seemed to offer something new. His was a positive and gregarious outlook, with lyrics that were, on closer inspection, much more philosophical, much more mindful than most of the here today, gone tomorrows who surrounded him on the pages of smash hits and the like. Earlier this year, he released the Engage album off the back of an ambitious multimedia project of the same name. And in early 2016, he's stripping things right back and embarking on a solo piano tour, which will feature songs and stories from his 32 years as a recording artist. We'll be looking back at his journey from small gigs in his hometown High Wycombe to Wembley Stadium and beyond. But before we talk, let's listen to him at the piano. My guest, Howard Jones. Howard Jones, welcome to The Mouthcast.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
I mentioned in my introduction that 2015 has been the year of Engage, yeah, or at least of taking that project to the wider public, because I imagine there were many months of planning and work went into it before that.
Yeah.
Next year, you're back out on the road as a one-man band, just you and your piano and the songs and the stories. I guess in some way that's a bit of a reaction to what was obviously such a technically complex project.
Yeah, yes, actually that's a good way of putting it. I mean, Engage was the most ambitious undertaking for me ever, because it was a multimedia thing, you know. So there was a whole year of planning and working and writing and recording and filming as well, because it had a big sort of visual element. I commissioned this 5-minute ballet piece, and also there's a contemporary dance section. And that involved, like, doing special films to go with the music. So, yeah, you know, the production was quite, you know, I mean, not on the scale of what people are doing now, but for me it was a big, big project. So really to come back to the songs and piano and doing a bit of chat is a nice antidote, really, to that.
Mm. I think you've often mixed it up, as it were. You're not shy of going out on the road on the 80s tours.
No.
But you also put out plenty of new material. You do the technically complex stuff. There's the piano stuff. And you're also getting into soundtrack work. You obviously like to keep it fresh, keep it stimulating.
Yeah, I mean, as long, you know, I think it's very important to be challenging oneself to do new things. Obviously, I'm totally aware that, you know, the 80s is where I started, and a lot of people only know me for those hits. But then I have an amazing fan following that really appreciates all the other stuff I've done as well. So it's really, for me, very important to look after both sets of people, really, and have the balance myself that I'm always writing new things and doing new things so that I can keep moving forward as an artist and a player and a singer. Otherwise, you know, everything just grinds to a bit of a halt and kind of slips backwards. So I'm always looking for new things to do.
Yeah. In terms of your performance, solo at the piano is probably much more liberating in that you can take the songs in any direction you want, shape the show as you go along, more room to breathe. Freedom, I guess, is what I'm getting at. There are less specific technical limitations to consider.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't have to be so concerned about arriving at certain positions at a certain time to play a certain riff, you know, and I can really actually just forget about the technical side of it completely and just sing and play and react to the audience and then talk, you know, quite a bit, which is really good fun. I think, you know, I do enjoy both things. And I think, as we were saying before, you know, it's good for me to mix it up so that things I learn doing the acoustic shows, I can take back to the electric shows as well. And also ideas for new songs and ways of doing songs. Also, you know, I have to really be on it with the singing. So it always develops my singing quite a lot when I go out and do the acoustic shows.
I guess that can be applied to your songwriting as well, though, in terms of the freedom. Do you write a lot at the piano?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I've got a Steinway at home, and I've just had it renovated. It's sort of 25 years old now, and my piano technician came and did some work on it, and it's almost like having a brand new piano again, and I'm back on there playing a lot every day, actually. So often the piano has been the place where all, you know, the ideas form, and then I take it to the synths and the bigger sort of orchestration palette and develop it from there. But often it, you know, the ideas do start at the piano. It's always been like that for me.
Well, you actually released a couple of albums of instrumental piano music, Piano Solos for Friends and Loved Ones, both beautiful records, I think, and both bringing into focus something I think we perhaps first saw on Boom Bap Respite, which was this kind of breath of fresh air B-side way back in 85. There was not only your melodic gift, but a great improvisational style, a great setting of mood. Obviously, although it's one instrument, I think it's perhaps more versatile. Would that be fair?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I'm very comfortable at the piano, and I don't really have to think about it too much because I've been playing since I was seven. So it's really, it's just that it's like walking or running or breathing or something. It's just part of me. So it frees me up to be more creative, I think. I think it's probably because I don't really have to think about anything technical at all. It's just sort of a natural process to play. Yeah. I've been thinking about that quite a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, as a keyboard player growing up, just playing the piano was never going to be enough for me because I wanted to extend the palette of sound, you know, and orchestrate the music with, you know, other keyboards and other sounds and then evolve that into having other kind of live musicians play with me, brass sections and string sections and backing vocalists and all that. And I love to work with, you know, I suppose the piano is quite a solitary thing and then the band is much more sociable. and you know, it's a bit more fun, really, you know, when you've got lots of people around you and you can have a laugh with them.
The piano's kind of downtime, like a palate cleanser almost.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you trained at Manchester's Royal Northern College of Music in, I think, 74 or so, which was really the era of prog rock. Lamb Lies Down on Broadway by Genesis came out at the end of that year, and I know you're on record as being a big fan of Peter Gabriel.
Yes, yes.
What was that, the influence that you were intent on bringing out in your music when you first got into bands?
Well, I mean, the first sort of proper band that I formed at school was a band called Warrior.
There's that great photograph of you all, I think, with you with really long hair.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I know, it's hilarious. It was an entirely instrumental band to start with. I just wrote these very long, convoluted, proggy pieces, really, you know, because that were very much influenced by my classical background, you know. So, I loved Genesis, and I loved Yes, and I really enjoyed, Keith Emerson was my absolute hero, because he combined his classical music with great rock and roll and jazz, and he threw it all together in the mix, and I just absolutely loved him, and also the fact that he used to stick knives in his ham, and, you know, it was like an extra bonus. So I was very much influenced by those bands, but also I really loved Stevie Wonder and the groove element of Life as well, which I always feel, you know, the prog guys, you know, they can't play in time. I mean, we can't hold it against them, you know what I mean? But actually keeping a steady beat, it was not really a priority. Whereas, you know, with bands like Steely Dan and Stevie Wonder, you know, you've got the groove, and I loved all that. And then I loved Elton John, because he was a piano player and he wore glasses like me, and, you know, and he wrote much more sort of sensitive songs. So it was really a combination of all those things, really, that sort of shaped my musical intention, I suppose.
There was no inkling to stick a fox's head on or anything like that.
Well, you say that, but one of the first shows I did is, you know, with a solo setup with me and the synths, I dressed as a half businessman, half punk, and I was split down the middle. And so that theatrical element was there right from the beginning. And then that developed to start using, you know, TVs on stage with, you know, computer-generated graphics, very primitive in those days, and also sort of videos. And then, of course, Jed came along, who actually then was assuming these different characters and roles. So, you know, the theatrical element has always been part of what I did. And I guess, you know, that there's a big influence from Gabriel and Genesis and those bands.
So to the tour next year, the stories you'll be telling, you'll be going right back to 82, 83.
Yeah.
There's something very romantic about your story at that time to me. You were around 28 years old. You were working in what I suppose we'd call dead-end jobs. You'd got married quite young. You were playing small gigs in and around High Wycombe, recording demos. You were really pushing to get somewhere, to get out of, you know, these jobs and this kind of standard life, if you like.
Yeah.
Did you feel at that age, at 28, that perhaps that chance had gone, I suppose?
Actually, no, you know, I didn't. I really, my thinking was not, it was very straightforward, if you know what I mean. I didn't really have a sort of sense of the bigger picture. Okay. I was very blinkered in my approach, which was that this is what I do. I love doing it. I want to do it full time, and I want to, you know, make this my life. I didn't really think about how old I was. Everyone always used to think I was younger than I was anyway, so it was never a sort of a problem. maybe immature is the word. It never would have even crossed my mind that I was too old to be starting out on this. It just really, you know, I just knew this is what I wanted to do. I didn't really care, I suppose. I just was very focused on, you know, I only had plan A, and I did not have an alternative. So it really was, I just had to do it.
Probably the fact that you didn't have plan B and plan C, if you like, is absolutely integral to driving you, really, isn't it? The fact there's no safety net.
That's right. I've always been quite a big risk taker, you know, and that, is, I suppose, is quite an example of it. I was just at the point where Jan and I had got this end of terraced house in High Wycombe, and I was doing like all kinds of jobs to try and fund the music, and I was just at the point where we were going to, you know, either sell the house or, and I mean, I didn't own it, I had a mortgage, but I was, you know, sell the house and raise more money to do the music, when actually things changed and I got signed. So, but I was totally prepared to do that. It was like whatever it was necessary, there was only one goal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, interestingly, you almost signed to Stiff Records. It was talked about in Richard Ball's great book that came out about a year ago. I don't know if you've read that, the story of Stiff Records. And you're described by one of the executives as, with great regret, I might add, as the one that got away, as if Stiff instinctively knew that you were going to be a big success. The impression given is that WEA snatched you away at the 11th hour.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit more complex than that, I think. From the outside, it sort of looked like that. But I think Dave Robinson, although he thought to himself, this guy is going to be successful, I wasn't the kind of artist that he was used to and used to signing. You know, Elvis Costello and Madness and all those great acts. Really, I didn't really fit in with the Stiff Records roster at all. And when I met Dave, I kind of, you know, I liked him. I could sense that at the back of his mind, he wasn't really sure about this. And I think the guy who was head of A&R, which was Paul Conroy, genius in the music business, was absolutely convinced that this was I was going to do well. And then he got invited to join the new team at WEA. And I was literally, there was an evening, I was playing the Lyceum in London, and I was going to sign the contract with Stiff. Paul Conroy marched into the dressing room and said, Howard, please don't sign it. There's something else on the horizon here. I'm moving to WA and I want to take you with me. And I was literally their first signing. So it was a bit more nuanced. And I ended up in the right place, I think, because yeah. I don't think it would have been right to meet Stiff, although I would have probably had much more credibility as an artist, if you know what I mean, which I didn't have.
Yeah. I think it's really pointless almost, but it's really interesting to follow that path of what might have been if you'd signed with Stiff. But you signed with WEA initially on a one single deal, a case of, you know, let's see how this goes. And if it's a hit, you can do more. I think around about that time, you actually supported Peter Gabriel at one point. And I also remember a Radio 1 session, I guess, not too long after you signed. So it was obviously a tremendously exciting time for you. You were seizing all of the chances that came your way.
Yeah. I mean, I've been waiting to do this since I was like 14 when I was in my first band. Yeah. And so it was, you know, it was suddenly the chains were unleashed and I was off. You know, I was absolutely going to go for it.
First single was New Song, came out in September 83. Really, really confident single, confident song, confident production. But were you surprised by the public's reaction to it? I mean, it was a big hit, it was a major hit. Were you surprised by that? Did you have much expectation of it yourself?
I remember the very first time I played the song live in the Osborne Arms, the pub, which is in Lane End, in outside High Wycombe, and people went absolutely mental, and it wasn't even in its sort of finished form. I had quite a lot of confidence that it would do well, you know. People just went crazy for it. So I thought, well, that's a really good, real indication of potential. But I mean, it did come in at number 109 or something. I mean, it was like, it looked like it was over right at the beginning, but it gradually crept its way over the next 3 months, you know, made its way to number three. But yeah.
Coming in at number 109, I guess in itself, that must have been quite exciting.
Yeah, but I still, it seemed like an, like, oh, you know, this is touch and go, whether this is going to... And in fact, you know, that is the truth. It was touch and go, whether it would just be lost. You know, there were so many people putting out so many good records at that time, and you're just in there trying to fight your way through it all. But, you know, it did gradually make its way up, yeah.
I actually really clearly remember hearing that song for the first time on the Breakfast Show on Radio 1. For 1983, it was very modern sounding. There was something very different about the lyrics, though. They were thoughtful, philosophical. Optimistic is perhaps not quite the right word. Positive, I think, is a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
Were you aware that you were doing something quite unusual in that regard?
Yes, I was very aware of that, and I was very conscious of that, and that it was very intentional. I was looking around at the sorts of bands that were my contemporaries, and some of it was quite dark, and you know, there is a place for that, and there absolutely is, but I just didn't want to be that kind of artist. I wanted to be the kind of artist that you put on the record when you need a boost, and not when you want to sort of wallow in misery. So, and I was very, very conscious, and I sort of knew at the back of my mind that I would get a lot of reaction from, you know, cool journalism and cool music papers. I sort of anticipated a reaction, and you know, and I did get that. So it was really good for me, because I had to fight even harder, you know, and work harder to, you know, make sure that I did, you know, I did make my way through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they were pretty divisive times, really, around the time that New Song came out. There was obviously the rise of Thatcherism. There'd been the Falklands War just a short time before. There was the miners' strike.
Yeah, and the Cold War, of course, as well, which was really quite a very frightening time, yeah.
I mean, you steered clear of that stuff, really, the party politics, the absolute nuts and bolts of it, really. To me, you were always on a different trip. It was a more spiritual outlook. But did that stuff affect you? Did it get into your writing or into your just general way of being?
I suppose that I've always believed that the big problem, that the big issues, the big world issues, will only fundamentally change when people decide to make a change themselves. When I was younger, intuitively thought that. Now I absolutely believe it. You know, if you want to change the world, you've got to start with your own behavior. And that's the way that I've felt that it works. So my songs have always been orientated in that way. Like, I've made a big thing about being a vegetarian, you know, because you have to make quite an effort to be a vegetarian. If you want to live a less violent lifestyle, then start with what you eat, sort of thing, you know. I mean, and it's always been where I've been coming from. And I think if you can't change yourself, then how do you ever expect anything else in the world to change? You know, if you can't behave respectfully towards other people in your own daily life, then how is anything else going to change?
I suppose, expanding on that, the tone of the first couple of albums, particularly songs like Equality, and the things you talked about in interviews at that time, I think it boiled down to be the most present version of yourself that
yes.
you can be.
Yes, absolutely.
That's obviously still really important.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been practicing Buddhism for 22 years now, and, you know, I've found that Buddhism really coincided with all those intuitive things that I believed as a young man. And, you know, I have sort of like a formal practice now that I can do to reinforce that and to keep moving along that, you know, in that direction.
Because I was going to ask you about Buddhism. whether it was a case of you finding it or finding that your beliefs coincided with Buddhism, and becoming a Buddhist has kind of opened up a wider framework for your thinking, really.
It's both things, really. I suppose, you know, I when I was young, I followed a guru for about 7 years, and it all went horribly wrong. And then I said to myself, I will never, you know, be part of any kind of formalized philosophical or religious group ever again. You know, that was it. Then I met Buddhism. I completely agreed with all the philosophy and the way of looking at the world. And so really, you know, everything changed from that point.
Heaven is somewhere locked inside, and I must find the key. Wish I'd never locked the door, yeah. Ordinary things in life are well as heaven likes to be. Oh, sky feet on the floor. Oh, sky feet on the floor. We make our sun to shine. We make our space and time. We make the weather. We make a change.
Now we're 30-plus years on from New Song, and you've been through a whole range of human experience, really. The professional success, the fame of the major label years, loads of hit singles and albums, the graft and excitement of the DIY years. You opened a restaurant. You've also stayed married to the same woman for almost 40 years, which is fantastic. You've had 3 children. Through all of that, has it been difficult to remain mindful of your ideals?
No, I don't think so at all. It was always the motivation right from the beginning, and I think it's got stronger and more focused, actually, that, you know, I'm much more aware about the things that I do and write and the way I conduct myself. I really need to think about it very carefully because people are watching, you know, and like me, you know, when I see people in the world that I think are great, I watch them and I see how they behave, and that influences me. So particularly with the songs that I write, I'm thinking about who's going to be listening to it and what sort of things they'd like to be discussing in their mind, you know, like things like when your kids grow up and they leave, how do you feel? And as an artist, I feel like it's important to describe that feeling so that other people can, who don't have the time perhaps to do that, you know, I can do that for them, and then they can go, yeah, that's how I feel. And I'm sort of more aware of the role of art and music, you know, in the bigger picture, you know, and I think I've become more like that as time, you know, time goes on.
I always wondered, considering the support, the push, actually, from WEA that you received early on, I've always wondered whether there was much resistance at that label, a major label, to the idea of you speaking about those things, whether you felt that there was pressure to kind of conform to being a pop star, really.
No, I never felt any pressure from them whatsoever. You know, the truth is, the way I look, the haircuts, the way my music was, that everything, that all came from me and the group of people that I'd grown up with and had been there with me when I was playing in the pubs and clubs, you know. The only, I remember one thing that Paul Conroy said to me, which has stuck in my mind, and it was brilliant what he said. I think I moaned a bit in one interview. You know, oh, I can't really go anywhere now because I'm recognized everywhere. And it was a kind of a bit of a moan. And it was the first time that he'd seen me do that. And he said, don't do that. People would die to be in your position. Mm. And I thought, well, that was really, really, that was really good advice. And it was also really in line with my thinking as well. So that's the only sort of reprimand I got was in a very good way.
Did you put a lot of pressure on yourself to, you just talked about, living up to the ideals that you were putting forth on your records. Did you put a lot of pressure on yourself to do that? I mean, you were never seen, for instance, out on the town, pissed out of your head or anything like that. That was not likely to be tabloid fodder, was it?
No, that's true. That's right.
I'm sure you had a drink or two in your time.
I did. I mean, I certainly had my moments, but I wasn't followed by paparazzi ever. You know, I just was not one of those people they were interested in, which was, you know, kind of good for me because I didn't really want to be known for that. I wanted to be known for the music. So I was just trying to be true to who I, you know, I have values I just wanted to uphold. And you know, that's what I did. I didn't think too much about it. Like I said, I wasn't very good when I was young about having an idea of the bigger picture. It was very much like what was going on in front of me. I can have much more circumspection now about it all. But at the time, it was like, I need to get on. You know, I need to be writing more great songs, and I need to be finishing the next album, and I need to be getting the band together for the next tour. And it was all very much what was in my face. It's only many years later that you can look back and go, oh, I can see what was happening now. And, you know, you see why all the things happened and in the way that they did.
Second album, Dream Into Action, was a big hit. We played at Live Aid. You were one of the highlights of the day, I think, for the song, but also for the simplicity of what you did. One song solo at the piano, and we're actually going to hear that performance at the end of this podcast. You've also jammed with Stevie Wonder. You've been in Ringo Starr's band. You had a single produced by Phil Collins, which became a big hit here, but an enormous hit in America. There's so much that you've done. Looking back across it, I guess it must be pretty difficult to pick out a particular highlight.
Yeah, I mean, the ones you've mentioned probably are the highlights. Certainly Live Aid was an incredible moment. I was very fortunate to have chosen that song to do. And the fact, as you say, you know, I did it on my own. And it felt, in such a huge event, a very personal performance, really. And I suppose, you know, I mean, I'm looking back on it now, you know, quite brave, really, because nobody even knew that I played the piano at the time. You know, they're thinking, oh, blimey, right now, how's he going to do? You know, he's just a one-finger synth guy.
Yeah. come on, press a button and off
you
go.
You must be joking. I started this song a bit fast, very nervous, and huge amounts of adrenaline pumping through me. I got to the chorus, and the whole of Wembley joined in. I mean, you can hear it on the recording, and it's just, it was an amazing feeling. I can still remember it. You know, it was like being totally supported. And if I had to choose one moment, it would be that, you know, the first chorus of Hide and Seek, Live Aid. And it was just an amazing day altogether.
I mean, it's incredible, really, because that was only about 18 months after your first flush of success, really. It, you know, the very, very quick journey from New Song and What Is Love and Humans Lib to that, it's an incredible story, really.
Well, you know, the thing was with Live Aid, I wasn't on the Band-Aid single, and I really felt that I should have been, and I felt it was my fault that I wasn't. I didn't push for it, and I didn't put myself forward enough. I felt, oh, you know, I was lacking in confidence, basically. But when I heard about Live Aid, I thought, I really cannot let this go. It's got to be the most important thing that you could do, maybe in the whole of the 80s. You know, it's a contribution to a much bigger thing. So I made sure that we got in touch with Geldof and that, you know, I was involved. And so I'm glad that I pushed for it, you know. I mean, I didn't know Geldof or anything, and I didn't have any connection with him, like I think a lot of the other artists did, but I did push for that, and fortunately I was involved.
Well, we're almost at the end of our time, and I don't want us to sign off with you giving away too many of your stories, the stories you're going to tell on the tour. But having said that, we are about to play out with that Live Aid version of Hide and Seek. So I do want to talk about the specific song. It's such an emotional piece of work. I think, not wishing to sound like Robert Plant, but it's a song of hope. What do you remember of the writing of it? Because the mood of it suggests that it may have been a valve to release some great existential angst or something.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, it's a big story, really, the song. I used to read a lot of philosophy books when I was younger, and there was a Welsh philosopher, actually, called Alan Watts, and he lived in California. And he was trying to marry up the Western view of life and death and the greater, bigger picture and the Eastern view of spirituality and everything. And there's a portion in his book where he talks about how you would describe God to a child, but in terms of not the Western way of looking at it, but the Eastern way. And he came up with this story. And basically, I based the song on reading, you know, after reading that book. And it's actually come to mean, you know, sometimes you feel very fortunate that you did say the right thing then, you know. Now I probably wouldn't be able to say it in the same way because I'd think too much about it. But it just sort of flowed out. And it's really about, I mean, there's no two ways about it. It's a very spiritual song. You know, I hope you find it and everything. I hope that you realize your connection to everything. Every single person is connected to everyone else. And this world is our collective world. And it's really important to realize this. You know, the things that I feel, you feel, and we're incredibly connected. And so really, that's the big point of the song. And I think that's why people regard it as their favorite track, you know. I hope so, anyway.
Well, thanks so much for your time, and good luck for the tour in early 2016. You're playing some great venues, I note. Union Chapel in London, Sheffield City Hall, Lincoln Drill Hall, City Varieties in Leeds, all of which I'm sure you're going to captivate with those great songs and the stories, particularly the one about Warrior. I think you should bring that photograph along.
Yeah, I should do that.
Well, that's the multimedia angle, just a big screen with that picture.
Actually, that's given me a great idea, Steve. I don't normally talk about Warrior, but I will on this tour.
Perhaps pull out one or two of the old Warrior numbers.
Yes. There's one called Squashed Cats Intestines.
Okay.
That shows you the age I was.
That was going to be the second single, but you went for What Is Love instead. You thought, oh. Right, well, thanks very much for your time, Howard Jones.
Thanks, Steve. Really enjoyed it. Brilliant, mate. All the best to you.
www.themouthmagazine.com.
Hello. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today, sharing this experience. was a time when there was nothing at all, nothing at all. Just an instant, huh? Was a being and he lived on his own. He had no one to talk to and nothing to do. He drew up the plans, learned to work with the sands. A million years passed by and his work was done. And his words were these:
www.themouthmagazine.com.